K is too little. Either way, you're going to have a prohibition of amount. In most cases, we're going to be talking about the seller, because that's usually the context in which it comes up. Usually the seller is the one who knows more. That's the nature of the situation. It's going to be rare that a buyer is going to be able to deceive a seller. It's not impossible, but it's a little bit less likely. So we'll mostly focus on the seller. The seller is usually the one who might know something the buyer doesn't know. So for the most part, if he charges too much, we'll focus on that more than the other. So then he is in violation of Ona. And that seems like it's a type of theft. You're basically stealing money by defrauding the other person out of it. And I could steal money by taking it out of your pocket directly. Or I could steal money by defrauding you. I tell you to invest in something which is fake. I tell you to give me all your money to hold while you go to the bathroom and then I run away. Well, that's a little more traditional. But if I tell you something false and that leads you to give me money you wouldn't otherwise give me, that's fraud. So in this context, it would seem like you're essentially stealing. Basically, the object is worth X. I tell you it costs 2X. Sounds like it's a kind of stealing. And indeed, the Gemara in Maseches Bava Metzia, it's the Gemara in Daf Samach Aleph, the Gemara discusses, why do I really need a prohibition of Ona? If I already have a prohibition of stealing, if I'm not allowed to steal, so I know, okay, I don't have to go through all the various permutations in which I could steal. So I don't have to list Ona either. So why does the Torah have to tell me this separately? And the Gemara addresses that question. How it addresses it is not so important. The Gemara says that essentially the difference is that here you willingly hand over the money. That differentiates it from stealing. So then the Gemara says, well, what about ribis, charging interest? That would also seem to, if I had ribis and stealing together, that should seem to cover all my bases. I wouldn't need a separate prohibition of Ona. So the Gemara says, well, this is in the context of transactions of Mekach u'Memkar. So that's why it gets its own separate prohibition. So there is an interesting question, just conceptually. How do you view that whole back and forth? Right, the premise the Gemara seems to start off with is that this is a type of theft. This was included in theft. I wouldn't need to actually list it. And we answer away however we answer. So what is the impact of that answer? We're basically saying, no, it's not theft. This is a business transaction. You have two parties who are willingly dealing with each other in the context of a give and take. And therefore, it needs its own source because it's really not theft, it's something else. Or is the conclusion that this is a chiddush in theft, that theft normally wouldn't extend to these kinds of scenarios, and the Torah tells us this is also a kind of theft. This could be a dispute. Reb Chaim Brisker, in his Sefer on the Rambam, seems to lean towards the first interpretation, the Pnei Yehoshua, and a Sefer at the Bava Metzia towards the second. Should emphasize, by the way, that in terms, I know people get scared in terms of tests and the like, so if I throw out a lot of names, I'm not necessarily asking you to remember a lot of names. I'm much more interested you should be aware of the basic concepts. I mention names for the purposes of edification and to give credit where credit is due, but you shouldn't let that distract you. If you're interested in knowing names, feel free to pay attention to them. If that's not what you're able to focus on so much, it's not going to play a major role in your grade or testing or anything like that. It's there for your edification. So for your edification, Reb Chaim Brisker in Hilchos Mechira tends towards the first possibility, that this is really not theft in the end of the day. This is a business transaction which happens to be prohibited. And the Pnei Yehoshua understands it more the second way, that this essentially, the Chiddush HaTorah is that this is basically a type of theft. Zev, you had a question? About to restate it. Okay, Chesky?
Yeah, is there an operator there? Like, maybe in terms of
I think certainly conceptually there is a difference. Cultural Aedis is interesting. In terms of Aedis, probably not, because what we disqualify for Aedis is Rosh HaDechamas, right? So it's not simply stealing, but anything that's motivated by monetary gain. So probably both would be included. But in terms of the concept, as we'll see, it does make a difference. You know, basically, what is it? And we'll see different ways in which it could make a difference. How are you doing, Joseph? Different ways in which it could make a difference, just conceptually. Is it that you're essentially stealing from the guy, or no? The fact is, you have a business deal here. Everyone has the ability to do their own due diligence, to do their own research. It's their own responsibility. The Torah tells us, no, that an extra, you have an extra step here that you have to adopt their concern for the other person and not mislead him and not just assume it's his job to do his own research. Hi.
In terms of communication perspective with someone who...
I'm sorry, which perspective?
Sorry, not from the relationship, from the parents' perspective.
Uh-huh.
Would someone who feels an unwanted business relationship, let's say,
with a couple of parents... So, asked that question, actually. So, he offered that as a possible nafkamina. So truth is probably they're both included because you don't have to, right, the pasul shvua just means you're suspected in general of violating laws, especially if they're monetarily related laws. So probably they're both going to be in that category anyway. Just a question of whether we perceive it as the whole thing is an act of theft, or is this a specific chiddush that there is a prohibition to deal with somebody in this way. So it's also important to note that there really are two different categories of onah, and they have some different laws. You could have onah in the cost. So I sell you the item for too high of a price, or buy it for too low of a price. Or there is also onah in the item itself, which is where you also find the term mekach tos. That if I sell you an item, and the item is flawed in some way, it's essentially defective, so then you pay full price and you don't realize, the Rambam writes that he basically work off the premise that everyone expects to get a perfect item when they buy it. So you sell an item that's less than perfect, so then that is a type of onah. It all boils down to the same concept. You're selling a differential between the value and what they're actually paying and what they're actually getting. But this is actually a more severe kind of onah. It has at least two ways in which it's treated more severely. One way is that there's no minimum. As we'll see, we'll discuss in a moment, when it comes to price differential, there's a minimum before it becomes reversible. But when you're dealing with an item being less than, qualitatively less than what it is, than what it looks like, so then the assumption is that any kind of differential in that area, the person's not getting what he thinks he's getting, that right away can cancel the sale. That right away is called a mekach tos. And we also find that there is no real time limit on that. That when it comes to a monetary difference, the price differential, so then his right, the buyer or the seller's right to cancel the deal, only extends until he has time to check out the price. He can go to an expert and find out what the price really is, then come back and say he was cheated. But after that time elapses, then he no longer has that right. But when it comes to the object being deficient, it seems to last forever. I don't know if Joseph was ever there. Joseph, Zev, Chesky?
Real quick, what's mekatos?
Mekatos, essentially, the words literally mean that the sale was a mistake. This was not there was no meeting of the minds. The person who bought this item bought it thinking it was something else, thinking it was a perfect item, and in reality, he was fooled. It wasn't a perfect item.
So, what item. If like a cheap, like anything, a DVD player, $40 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you buy it, and a month later, you just got a bad piece. It was a lemon, it broke, whatever. And the guy's like, "I'm sorry, every one out of every 5,000 is just."
So that's a part of it. It actually leads to another point I'll make in a second. So hold off the question for a second. See what Zev wanted to ask.
Yeah, I mean, does it work both ways? Can the buyer actually be getting a much better product than the seller?
Meaning, so in the product realm, right? In the price realm, it's possible. In the product realm, it's a little bit harder for that to be the case. You know, theoretically, I guess, you know, with a diamond, something like that, you could theoretically have a scenario where the person is selling something that's worth much more than he realizes, and it's theoretically possible. It's more conceivable when you're dealing with the price, the person, the payer is paying too low of a price. And again, in both cases, while it really applies both ways, in the modern market, it's just a little bit less common that it's going to be going that way. Chesky?
Even by that toes, though, is it that we're saying that there's no such thing, or that in terms of mechila, right, we might assume it also by mekach tos in certain cases, just that we don't have it as originally set up. Like in money, we could just say a 6 and work underwards.
Yeah, no. So I'll address that point in a second. Also, I know what
so
you.
Even in Metcalf Toast, there's certain times where we say, "Oh, that's much." The person will accept this much. You won't.
Right. So I'll address that point. I'll address both these points together. So now you may argue, theoretically, that there are some circumstances where certain things can be figured out, and there is a due diligence responsibility on the part of the buyer, that the buyer should look carefully at what he's buying and get a sense of whether it's really all that it's cracked up to be or not. And if it's really concealed, it's the kind of thing that the buyer won't know until he opens up the package and he can't bring it back anymore and he's too far away. So then that's one thing. But if he's able to look at it, look at what's in front of him, and figure out that it's not complete, so maybe that's his responsibility. So there's a certain logic to that. It seems to be, it's possible that it's a machlokas rishonim if that was true. Some rishonim do assume that way, that the tshuvas hagaonim and others, that if it's something that the person can figure out, that's really his responsibility to figure it out. Some thought that the Rambam sounded a little bit not that way, and there are some contemporary authors who offer the resolution, which makes a lot of sense, that basically, and this relates a little bit to what Joseph was asking, that it depends, are we dealing with new stuff or old stuff? That when you're dealing with old stuff, so used things, so then you know that there's all kinds of variables. We know that things tend to not be exactly in perfect shape, and therefore, the kind of things that you could see on your own, presumably you're expected to take a look and to realize it on your own. If it's something that you can't perceive, there's some kind of secret problem, then that wouldn't be the case. But if it's something that they can figure out, so that if they're buying something used, so then they should know that that's the situation. If it's something new, so then people generally think that a new item is in perfect shape, so then if there's something that's not so perfect about it, maybe you'd be obligated to actually point that out. And in terms of Joseph's specific case, where even new items, maybe there is a certain percentage where they just don't work. So if that's really the case, that just they're all made identically, but 1 out of 5,000 happens to be 11, so to speak, so then that's probably also true, that that's a simple fact of life, a simple risk factor that exists in all normal purchases, and that's presumably not the seller's violation. But there is this difference between old stuff and new stuff. I was thinking this actually happened to me, that I had a car once upon a time, and I took the car to the mechanic, and the mechanic told me that the car had the most problems with it he's ever seen, and that it would cost such and such a bill to have it fixed, that it's much more than a new car would cost, and a new used car would cost, and it's not worth fixing. So it was a very depressing diagnosis, and that was right before I came into yeshiva one day. So then I took the car and I came into yeshiva, and it happened to be that just that day, as I'm pulling in for some random reason, pulling into the garage, the security guard asks me if I'm interested in selling him my car. So I don't want to violate or not. So I told him that I have to tell you that I just got a diagnosis from the mechanic that this car needs more repairs than he's ever seen in any other car, and it would cost more to fix it than to buy a new car. So he said to me, he's confident that he knows cheaper ways to fix it, he might still be interested. So I said, I don't want to cheat you, so here I have with me the list of all the things wrong with it. So I gave him the list, he read the list, and he still decided he wanted to buy it. So he, knowing all that, so he decided to buy it, and it happened to be yesterday morning as I was going to the garage, I asked him, how long has it been? He said, it's been about 2 years. About 2 years, he's only seen nachas from the car. So apparently some people have different ways of valuing things, so he had a way to fix it that it was worth paying for. So the mechanic, it's rained. Right? Right, I know. I never thought of that before. It would be really pretty elaborate because it was a mechanic in New Jersey and a security guard here.
It's only 20 minutes.
Right.
It could be one.
Yeah, that's true. That would probably be no. But yeah, that would be a very elaborate plot. If it was, they deserve it because it was a pretty elaborate plot. But in any event, so he, I gave full disclosure. I gave him the whole list of everything the guy said was wrong. He still wanted to buy it. And I see him every day, so even if I wanted to cheat him, it wouldn't be a good idea. And he's been happy with it for 2 years now. Okay, so different people are able to value things differently. So that that has to do in terms of the value of something. Now, Chesky raised a point before that there are still different gradations, and that's important to emphasize, and we'll try to get back to this topic. It touches upon next week's topic, that next week's topic officially is Gnevas Das. Right, so Gnevas Das also plays a role here, because theoretically, Onah, Mekach Tos, at least when we're dealing with a product, in terms of the product being full, being complete, so strictly speaking, we only mean that the sale would be reversed if it was a situation where the person wouldn't want to buy it under those circumstances, or wouldn't want to pay as much as he paid under those circumstances. But if it's a kind of a minor flaw, that the person would still buy the object, and especially if he would still buy it at the same price, so then we don't really have oh no in that circumstance. However, we do have a different consideration. And that's something we'll have to, it'll really be next week's topic, and we'll come back to it. But next week we'll talk about Gnevas Das. So Gnevas Das is something that applies in all areas of life, business, and elsewhere. But in general, it applies in day-to-day life if I create false goodwill. If I give you the impression that I'm doing you a favor, and I'm really not doing you a favor, I'm just making you think so. So now you feel indebted to me, and we'll say that in the emotional sense, not in the monetary sense, to keep it simple, but you feel like you owe me a favor, you feel like I'm a really great guy because I did you this favor, and really I didn't do you any such favor, so that's Gnevas Das, and that'll be a topic we'll get into in more detail. But what's relevant here is that Gnevas Das applies in a business context as well. So if I sell you something that isn't worth what I claim it's worth, and you pay more than it's worth, and you would not have bought it had you known the truth, or you would not have paid as much as you did had you known the truth. So then that's a reversible error. That's essentially a mekach tos. But if you would buy it, let's say I sell you this, I sell you my car, and I sell you the car for $1,000, and it's worth $1,000. But I tell you, wow, this car is really a great deal. It's really worth a lot more. And just because I like you, I'm giving you this lower price. So you are paying the same amount you would expect to pay for the item you're expecting to get, but you falsely believe you're getting a better deal than you're getting. So you essentially credit me for giving you a better deal when I'm really not giving you a better deal. So then you potentially have a problem of Gnevas Das. There's no actual money violation, but it is a Gnevas Das violation in the context of business. So that theoretically could be a problem. So if I misrepresent the item, even if it's not material enough for you to want to reverse the sale, or that you wouldn't have bought the sale had you known the full truth, still potentially a Gnevas Das issue, and that could cause all kinds of complications, which we'll come back to. So that is if you're buying a product, and the product is not all it's cracked up to be. But usually we talk about onah in the context of the price differential. And there, so we have a different set of rules. There we have a standard of a sixth. That sixth, that's about 16%, a little more than 16.5%, that if there's a 16.5% differential in either direction, more than that, that's where you have a real problem. That's called onah ubatel mekach. Then the sale is essentially canceled, assuming that the violated party wants to cancel the sale. If he doesn't want to cancel the sale, then it doesn't have to be canceled. If he changes his mind later, decides he wants to keep it, so then he's entitled to do that. But that's essentially the first rule. Hi.
It's a six or more than a six?
More than a six. So if it's exactly a six, so then the rule is the sale is good, but you return the differential. And if it's less than a sixth, so then nothing changes. The sale goes through and nothing gets returned. And this concept of a sixth, so we don't really see this in the Torah. The Torah says, lo sonu, doesn't mention these numbers of 16% or 1/6. We don't find the psukim explicitly explaining that percentage. So the Sefer Yireiim writes that this is Chazal figuring out where the lines are generally drawn. And what that's based on, we'll talk about more in a second. But essentially, Chazal calculating that this is how much people are willing to put up with, and that's where you, we'll explain that more in a second, and that's where they got this differentiation. Now, the actual principle of exactly a sixth, so as Yonatan was just asking about, so as you can imagine, that's kind of hard to really find in real life, how precise we could be that it's going to be exactly a sixth differential. That's hard to find. And contemporary authors write that this is a concept that doesn't really apply in a modern setting. That in a modern setting, so we have a hard enough time figuring out the basic concept of Ona because of differences between different markets. We'll talk about in a minute. But the idea that we could figure out that it's going to be exactly a sixth, there essentially is no applicability of that in-between category. So it's either too little or too much. It's either going to be more than a sixth, which would include both rights, that you could either cancel the wholesale or demand the return of the differential, or it's going to be less than a sixth where none of these penalties are triggered. Hi.
Is there something that this law is based on? Specific.
The number?
Yeah, or is it just something they picked out?
So that's what the Sefer Yireim is explaining. This is what Chazal assessed. In general, most of the shiurim that we have, when we talk about measurements of all the areas of Torah, so it's rarely the case, almost never the case, that the Torah actually identifies
so
the shiurim.
Have Ramazim and things like that.
Rarely. Yeah, that's
like Kazayas.
Yeah, it's because the Pasuk mentions it, but it doesn't apply it to anything. The Pasuk lists all these different foods, and then the Gemara says that all those foods come up in different areas, but
right,
they're not. It's not mentioned in connection with those. So, for example, you can't eat a Kazayas of Chametz on Pesach. So the Pasuk in Akev mentions Zayas, but not in the context of Chametz on Pesach. There's no real connection from the Torah.
If
so
we're going to throw a sixth out the window and say it doesn't really apply.
We're not totally throwing it. We're not throwing out the window. We're saying that the exact sixth, which is the middle case, then it's going to be an exact sixth differentiation. That's pretty hard to imagine. You're going to really encounter such a circumstance because there's so many variables. We'll talk about
in
a second.
We don't say that about, let's say, or whatever, we still say.
No, but you can theoretically have. You can choose how much to have, and we could figure out what it's obviously going to be a topic of a lot of debate, but we could figure out what a kazayas or a kibbutz is, and then we could say, okay, I eat that much or I didn't eat that much.
Right.
But when it comes to here, we're talking about some exact number, which is not relevant except in relation to other numbers in the market, and to be able to calibrate that exact number is going to be...
Varies.
Right, that's not really feasible in a modern context. So that's a possibility. So this leads to a very important question about this less than... Also, just in terms of your question, so the shiurim in general, we generally say they're halachah l'moshe mi-Sinai, that they were transmitted on a deraisa level from Sinai. Sometimes some assume that some of the shiurim Chazal had an input in calculating. So here it seems that Chazal basically assessed what the number is that one would be at such a violation that it would trigger a reversal. So the Rush, and other Rishonim as well, the Ramban, the Sefer Achinuch, the Rush has a famous discussion about this in the fourth parak of Bav Metzia, it's in Simen Chaf. The Rush raises the question, so what are we saying about less than sixths? Are we saying that it is prohibited, it's asur, but just there's no consequence? As we often find when we talk about measurements in the Torah, right? So you talk about shiurim. So if you eat a Hershey's Kiss made of chametz on Pesach, so that's not punishable, but that's an issur d'oraisa. That's a Torah violation. So when we talk about having onah less than a sixth, so is that asur and just not punishable, or are we going to assume that's actually permitted? That's actually something that will allow. Avi?
I mean, unless I misunderstand the onah, a minor form of onah is what we call business. So,
I think you're talking about profit?
Yeah.
Right. So that actually, we haven't reiterated this time. I'll come back to that point. But I think we mentioned it last week when we introduced the topic, that the differentiation between the 1/6 and where it started from, that's not in terms of a markup. And that's not the difference between wholesale and retail. That's where profit is. It's worth clarifying that the seller, he buys an item retail, and then buys it wholesale, rather, and then he sells it retail. Right? So the sellers get the items for less, and then they make their profit and the difference between what they pay and what they charge. So they're allowed to charge, for the most part, whatever they want. They can make whatever percentage profit they want to make. That's not limited. In some sense, it is. It's limited for other reasons. And the Shulchan Aruch says that the Bate Din should make sure that people are provided for, so that vendors don't charge crazy amounts of markups, so that people are unable to buy what they need, and especially basic staples in life. So the Gemara says that there is an appropriate percentage of a markup, but for the most part, that's not what we're talking about when we talk about Onah. Onah is not the difference between what the seller paid for it himself and what he's charging now. It's not about his profit. It's about the difference between what other people charge and what he charges.
Right, but that's assuming, if you're going to differentiate between profit and Onah, you're going to assume that there's a clear universal price, that everyone marks up, everyone buys at 25 cents and everyone charges 50 cents, but generally, as we live more fluid, people generally buy at X and generally mark up 30%, so you might buy a little bit lower or mark up a little bit higher, but within a certain range, you have to be normal.
So yeah, so you're...
Someone who does is going to have to be forgiven, though.
Right, so that's basically what the rush is going to come out and conclude, as we'll see in a second. But that fluidity, especially in the contemporary market, is a big factor in how these laws are going to play out. Brett, did you have a question?
No.
Okay, but that's just important differentiation. We talk about adding on a sixth. We're not talking about his profit. We're talking about the other stores. All the other stores charge $20, and he charges $30, so he's adding on 50%. But if he paid $2 and he's charging $20, that's not necessarily, oh no, it may be inappropriate for other reasons. It may be a exploitation of the market. But that's not the specific prohibition we're talking about here. Hi.
Couldn't you say that any form, regardless of how significant the damage is, any form of this kind of, it's like almost an immorality, that you're tapping into something here that should be illegal, I mean, from the Torah's perspective at least. It's the same thing with, like, lying, as long, even if it's not, you're not damaging anyone, so there's no focus about that, but, I mean, certainly here, it's not clean, someone's losing something.
So that's essentially the question, and that's what the Ramban assumes, and that's what others assume, and that's one of the possibilities in the Rush, that when they pose this question, should we say that if you add on, are you doing anything wrong if it's less than a sixth? So that's basically the nature of the assumption, that we're saying that, okay, you're basically cheating the other guy. You're not cheating him in a way that is going to rise to a certain threshold, but maybe essentially it's still wrong. Maybe that's still considered to be a problem. And that's the way the Ramban assumes. And that's one of the possibilities in the Rush. The Rush basically posits that the reason you have this 1/6 window is because there is this variability within the markets, and therefore people are going to not be able to really insist on anything less than a sixth. They're going to basically be mochel. They're going to basically waive their rights. And therefore we can't deal with anything less than a sixth in terms of having any kind of actionability. So that itself suggests a lot of things. It suggests on one level that maybe it's still wrong to knowingly deviate. If you're the seller, you're the one imposing that differentiation. Or theoretically, if you're the buyer, it could also come up. But again, let's focus on the seller for a second. So it's wrong for you to impose this problem, even if it's not going to be actionable. But at the same time, the premise is that the buyer understands that there's a certain amount of fluidity, as Avi said, and therefore it's not something that he can really get himself to worked up about. Brett?
On what grounds would it be wrong under a sixth if we're going to say that those are regular market fluctuations?
Because if you know for yourself, right, that it's really the market price really is $20. And you say, but I can get away with making it 21, 22, because the purchaser is not going to be able to nail me down that specifically. He's not, how's he going to come? He's going to come to a Beis Din and he's going to bring the prices in every store in a 2 mile radius, and he's going to be able to prove that I'm a sixth differentiated. So he's not going to be able to do that. So I can get away with charging a little bit more. So one possibility Rush considers is maybe that is considered to be a normal practice. But the other possibility, which is what Yosef was saying, is that, no, essentially you're still exploiting the other guy. You're just recognizing that you could do it in a way that can't by its nature be actionable, and maybe that is essentially wrong. So the Rush concludes, the Shulchan Aruch brings like this, the Rush says, l'halacha, that what he recommends is, since essentially it's a question, that you as the one, let's say again, let's focus on the seller, so you as the one making the price, so you should not do this to anyone else because it's wrong. But if somebody else does it to you, you should recognize that there isn't anything that can be done about it, and you should be mochel and move on and accept it. Hi.
If somebody has access to very cheap price, like he gets it at half the price that the other distributors get it, can he then charge more because he's charging a difference of more than a sixth, maybe?
Yeah, but again, it doesn't matter how much profit he's making.
You're talking about the market.
Right. So if he'll charge the market price, he's lucky. He'll get a higher profit than everybody else because he pays less.
Is there an issue with maybe like Nevas Adas? If he charges less than everyone, wow, look at this guy. He's charging so little. Really, he's making four times the profit of them because he has better access to it.
I mean, if you assume people are going to credit him for...
They might. Oh, that is the nicest guy. He charges so little.
I guess you have to depend. It depends a little bit on the context. I think, you know, when you, the whole store, when the store in general is has a lower price range, I think people understand that's his business model more than he's doing anybody any favors.
Right, that's a good point.
But something to think about. So, in any event, so this is what the Rush basically assumes, and that whole point that there is this differentiation in the market, and therefore people are not going to be able to figure out exactly what's going on in that sub-sixth realm, and so therefore they're going to be mochel. So that recognizes, by its very nature, a certain flexibility in the market. And therefore, one could argue, and this is something that Rabbi Levine, Zichrono Livracha, discusses in his books, that based on the Rush noting already that there is a differentiation in the market, that the fact is, in the modern market especially, so stores have all kinds of different arrangements and all kinds of different costs that go together with those arrangements. So one store will have a showroom, one store will just have a catalog. One store will have great customer service and one store won't. And those differences, that could already allow for a valid difference in the price, and that might already fudge things a little bit. And his working assumption is that, assuming that the purchaser has some likelihood of valuing that differentiation, so the store with a showroom costs more than the store without a showroom, under the assumption that the purchaser recognizes there is this difference because he'd rather be able to go into a store with some customer service and with a showroom and to understand that that's incorporated into his cost a little bit. Hi.
In a previous class, I just learned about Grey Goose, the vodka company, that the way they made so much money and they're so successful is because they entered the market by marking up their prices significantly higher. That was not normally higher than other vodkas. And they played on the human tendency to think that, well, if it's such high price, then it must be of greater quality, even though it really wasn't. But that's how, that was a marketing strategy that they used, and it's been working. So is that legal according to this, where you know it's, I mean, you're...
And they're selling the same item.
Sorry? They're selling pretty much, yeah, they ship it from France as opposed to where these other places are, but if you were to
If they ship it from France, then they have actual shipping costs.
That's one of their reasons why they claim that there's quality difference, but you can't actually, even with that quality difference, you wouldn't price it that high based on your experience with it.
Yeah, it's a somewhat subtle point. If they're really selling the same item, and they're falsely giving you the impression that it's a better item. So then there probably are a few levels of deception involved there, including Ona. But there's also the fact that it goes back to the showroom point, and you have to figure out exactly which one is the more appropriate model, that sometimes they're selling their product in the context of a certain class ambiance and the like, and people knowingly pay for that. So to give probably the best example, so if you want to get Coke in a hotel lobby, right, so you know that, or in a fancy restaurant, so you certainly don't think that their Coke is any better than the Coke you got in the bodega. In fact, you know it's worse because they serve it in a cliché and there's no fizz whatsoever. And it's definitely better tasting when you get it from the fridge in the bodega. So no one is fooled into thinking that the Coke is any different. It's that they recognize that part of the whole package of the ambience of this place is that it trickles down into the cost of everything. And that's the reason why a one cup of flat Coke in the hotel lobby costs five times as much as a 2-liter bottle in the bodega, because of the context. So people do recognize that to a certain extent. So the point regarding the rush is well taken, except that really you can go further than that, because it's true that this 1/6 differentiation is made a little bit murkier because of the greater differentiation that we have in modern markets. But the truth is that also plays a big role in figuring out whether it is ona or not. And not just the question of 1/6, but really any percentage of ona is going to really depend on your having a comparable market. You have to be able to compare it to other types of stores that do the same thing. If you're going to say, well, this store charges me this much, but on the internet I can get it for less, but on the internet they have no overhead and they don't have any customer service, et cetera, et cetera. So you understand you're dealing in different markets. Or if you know that, say to use an example close to home, you know that the Svarm sale charges less than your local Svarm store. So then you can't claim that your local Svarm store is being ma'ani you. So we know that a one-time limited fare, for the most part, usually has lower prices than other places. Or we know that a professional show, a professional convention, will sell items at a lower price. We know that there are various contexts in which price rates are different, so in order to establish that there is ona in the first place, you have to be dealing with at least comparable markets, at least similar types of things. Then, once you're doing that, then you can get up to the rush's point that within those markets, if it's less than a 6, you can't really tell, because the markets themselves are still providing slightly different things. Hi. Is that?
What about monopolies?
Yeah, so then that would also be a big exception. So it would come out that if you have a monopoly, essentially, so then you really don't have a ona in this context. You have other problems. Again, if you're going to exploit people, especially if you're selling necessities, and if you're selling things people can't live without, so then there are other moral, ethical, and halachic problems in setting your prices at a level that is burdensome upon the population. But then you're indeed not going to be subject to the principle of ona. Rabbi Levine, I've referred to his writings so far a couple times. He has an essay, not in his regular economics books, but he has an essay that he published for our Parsha book called Mitoch Ohel, the YU Parsha book, where he wrote about Parsha's Toldos, and he has a fascinating discussion there about the selling of the birthright, that Esav sold the birthright to Yaakov, and Yaakov bought the birthright for a bowl of soup. It wasn't even fleishik, right? It was a bowl of lentil soup. So would you think that perhaps Yaakov was in violation of ona? That essentially here he's paying way too little for this. This birthright, something so valuable. So why is this not a violation of ona on his part? And he has a very fascinating analysis, certainly recommended reading, where he explains that there the proper context was a bilateral monopoly. That it was a monopoly in both directions, because you have an item which only one person in the world is able to sell, and there's only one person in the world who's interested in buying it. So you have a monopoly from the seller's perspective, and you have a monopoly from the buyer's perspective. So under those circumstances, you don't really have a principle of ona. you have essentially the right to the two parties to determine the market. The market is completely comprised of these two people, so that will define itself, and that wouldn't really be subject to Ona. The question was just, as he goes on to discuss, was Yaakov essentially exploiting his desperate state? And then he goes on to explain why even that wasn't the case, why essentially there were other reasons why that was the perfect time to create this deal in a neutral setting without any disadvantage in either direction. Hi.
Why would it be so problematic to say Yaakov was over Ona? Because I mean, like, there are times where obviously under certain circumstances, certain actions are in place.
So you're saying theoretically, if it was actually something we would otherwise prohibit, there's no question that...
obviously in terms of the importance in terms of the history of who would have...
Right, so you know that there are reasons to justify the violation of certain prohibitions. So it seems like from the rest of the parsha, perhaps, that there are greater causes at stake. At the same time, if it's possible to understand it with a minimal violation of anything, we'd certainly prefer to read it that way, and that's what Rabbi Levine goes on to prove, that essentially, based on the facts and the circumstances, quite a worthwhile essay if we had time to go through it in more detail. But essentially his opening premise is that we don't really have Ona in that context because it is A, monopoly, and B, it's a bilateral monopoly. The monopoly goes in both directions. Yosef, you have a question? Okay, so that's essentially the working understanding some of these Rishonim take. And what you then find is that there is, and this, some of the Ramban emphasizes, that there is a differentiation between the prohibition and the consequences. So we have a prohibition of Ona, and we have these consequences that theoretically the sale could be reversed, or in the very theoretical circumstance, the sale won't be reversed, but the 1/6 Ona will be returned. So those are the consequences. So what emerges is that they don't really match up, that you should not come to the conclusion, that was the Rush's opening question, but you should not come to the conclusion that they're completely dependent on each other, that you only have the prohibition where you have the consequences. But in reality, we see that's not true, that you can have the prohibition even when you don't have the consequences. And you find there are certain exceptions that Talmud talks about, which... that's what the Ramban emphasizes, expresses this idea. So, for example, this is how the Ramban really proves the point, is that the Talmud says there's no Ona when it comes to karka, when it comes to land. So there is essentially no principle of Ona. So what does that mean? So do you mean to tell me then that it's not prohibited to cheat somebody when you're selling real estate? That would be quite a loophole. Is that really what we're saying? Sorry? Right.
No, isn't it because karka lasts forever, so any price you pay for it is going to be...
No. I'll tell that to the real estate agent. They'd be very happy to hear that. Sorry? So, yeah, but the question is, so what is the, what do you, even the words mean? That's what the Ramban is by. The Ramban is commentary to Chumash. Tries to figure out what the words mean. Chesky?
Well, I mean, it is a vigorous custom, but one could... essentially suggest, like what you were just saying, that there's this concept that people even buy land just for a day, right? Because land is so valuable and so worth it to people. So because of that, you see that people act in like crazy ways about land. And therefore, there's no such concept of being overcharged because maybe you is worth it.
So to a certain extent, that's true. But that's what the Ramban basically assumes based on that, also because it's also clear from Sukkim in the Torah that there is a violation of Ona in relation to land. The Torah talks about, in terms of the selling of a steachuza, that it's clear from the Torah that there is a prohibition of cheating, in the context of hektish, but of cheating people in regards to land. You want to comment about that?
Yeah, it's also hard to find a market by inherently land. They have their location, so they can't. It might be hard to find a market, but all the same.
Yes and no. Again, you know, I've been holding in this partial lab recently. It does. There certainly is a, you know, a market and a standard for how you evaluate what real estate is worth. But it is. There's still some truth to that point. But essentially, what the Rashbam says in his commentary to Bava Basra, that he assumes it doesn't apply to land because people will sometimes be so crazy about a certain piece of land that they will pay exorbitant amounts. And you see, the Rush's basic principle, when the Rush says that less than a sixth a person is mochel, so more than that he's not mochel, that the working assumption of the whole nature of the Isser is that if I could go down the block or I could go across the street and I could get a significantly better deal, and the only reason I'm not doing that is because I didn't know about it, because you are deceiving me. And not because the other place is discounted, that's on his own cheshbon, but the other place is the basic rate, and you are deceiving me and taking advantage of the fact that I don't know that. So I'm not mochel you. I am essentially makbid, I am essentially exerting my right to be angry at you and to insist on a reversal. And they're less than a sixth, so you don't have that attitude, because there is such a fluctuation. Which the whole idea of mechila here is also very instructive, because when we talk about mechila, we talk about somebody waiving his rights. So there is an assumption, for example, in halacha, that you're only obligated to return if you steal something. You're only obligated to return if it's a shava pruta, right? Whatever that is, let's say about 2 cents nowadays. So if it's worth a certain amount, you're obligated to return it. Less than that, you're not obligated to return it. But it's generally understood, as the Magen Mishnah comments and others explain, that it's still usur, still usur min haTorah to steal anything, any amount. No matter how small, you're still not allowed to steal it. It's just that in terms of returning it, so people are not going to pay attention, it's not significant. If it's such a small value, people don't expect to get it back, so they're mochel. So the fact that you're not obligated to return such a small amount never meant that you're allowed to steal it in the first place. It means that you're not obligated to return it. Hi.
It's like yush is implied, you're saying?
Yeish is really a different category. It's mochel. It's mechila. Yeish means something else.
But you owe them that thing still.
Right, but the person's not gonna want it back. He's not going to pay attention to it. He doesn't stand on his rights. Question about that?
Well, doesn't the Rambam say that it's not specifically that it's usher, but it's just... is a bad character trait?
It's not clear. If the Rambam says that in other contexts. Rambam actually says about that. That's in the very first halacha in Hilchos Gzeila V'Aveda and Hilchos Gneiva. In both places, he says that it's aser, and that's where the Magen Mishnah comments it's really an aser min haTorah. It's really a bad character trait. He probably talks about stealing as a joke. Is that what you're thinking of? Could be. I don't think he says it there. I think he says it elsewhere. Hi.
I mean, it might be wrong, but I thought I remembered learning that dealing less than a shava pruta, someone gets malchus for it, they were over the isser, whereas normally someone can undo the lechid of malchus through returning whatever it was that they stole.
The Menchas Chinuch thought you should get malchus for it. That was the Menchas Chinuch's kasha, that normally the reason you don't get malchus for stealing is because you can return it. So the Menchas Chinuch said, oh, when it comes to... the Menchas Chinuch actually also said that about stealing by a joke. He says, since you're giving it back anyway, you should get malchus, right? So that's the discussion that you should get right. Menchas Chinuch is talking about that subject. But, right, that's basically the point, that it's still an isser in stealing, less than a shava pruta. It's just the returning is not expected. So to here, you're essentially saying that there really is a separation between the consequences and the Isser itself. But it's interesting because the Rush's assumption that there's Mechila, so why should there be Mechila on this kind of a differentiation? That if you say, okay, less than a Sheva Pruta is not a significant amount of money, fine. But a sixth of an item's value might be very significant. If you're buying a car, if you're buying a house, a sixth could be a ton of money. It's going to be a lot more than a shava pruta. So why should we assume people are mochel such a significant amount of money? So it seems to be, what you see from the Rush here, is that it's not that they're mochel the money. It's that the whole nature of how they lost the money is through the assumption that you are cheating them. And they're not going to consider themselves cheated if the price is so close to what the price is otherwise going to be. So it goes back to our original question, that it's not that onah maybe is possibly not theft in the traditional sense. The money is legitimately coming to the seller because he is in an open negotiation with the buyer, but it's that the nature of how he's obtaining it is a violation. The fact that he's charging a higher price is a violation. If that higher price is proportionately closer to the original price, so then the buyer will not consider himself cheated. So it's not about how much money, it's about how close it is to the original price. That itself is a interesting distinction. So when it comes to land, so you find that the Gemara says it doesn't apply when it comes to land. And the Ramban says, what, you're telling me there's no prohibition to cheat people when it comes to land? Can't be, it's not true, it's against the Torah. So it must mean that you see from here that there's a separation between the penalty and the prohibition. There's a prohibition, for sure, to cheat people when it comes to land. But there's a penalty only outside of that context, in other kinds of contexts. So, for example, the Rush over there, the Rashbam of Baba Basra comments that, the Rashbam comments that this is because people are willing sometimes to really go crazy over a piece of land, and this could be similar, maybe this was Yonatan's point, that it really doesn't totally fit the model that you find by other items, that the guy says, oh, I could just go down the block and buy this item at the other store for cheaper. So property doesn't totally lend itself to that type of consideration because this property is only here. So maybe you could find the comparable house somewhere else, but then it's going to be somewhere else. You know, we know real estate, the three most important considerations, you know, location, location, and location. So by definition, you don't have any two really identical pieces of land. And if it's identical, it's somewhere else. By definition, it's never going to be the same. So perhaps you do have this basis to say that people genuinely could be mochel. They could say, whatever it costs, I'm going to take this. So it's still wrong of the seller to exploit that kind of a differentiation, but nonetheless, there's no consequence of the land being returned. Now, does that mean never? So that's a little bit of a machlokas. It's a machlokas between the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch following the view of the Rambam, and the Rambam following the view of the Rush, and the Ashkenazi Rishonim, that the Shulchan Aruch essentially says, yeah, it's basically infinite. If I sell this land for 100 times its value, it's still not reversible. And the Rambam and the Rush say, no, there is a limit. That if it's going to be a 50% excess, if it's really so much more that it's really completely out of whack, so then there would be such a thing as bitul mekach even by land. It's just the normal rules of more narrow margins. That's not applicable to land. Chesky, you have a question about that? Yeah, the question of whether it goes infinite or not. Right. So you do find some of those exceptions. Some of those separations. You also find that for technical reasons, the Gemara says that the penalty doesn't apply in interactions between a Jew and a non-Jew. But the prohibition certainly does apply. The prohibition of cheating certainly does apply. There's a tshuva about this in the Mishkanes Yaakov, that somebody had made a business arrangement with a non-Jew, and he made an outrageous price for a boat, something like that. And he thought he could get away with it. And this non-Jew, he hadn't paid the money yet, and he realized that he was being exorbitantly overcharged. So he was willing to go to the Jewish court to have the matter adjudicated. And it took a while before it got to Mishkanes Yaakov. Mishkanes Yaakov essentially explained that maybe the consequences in terms of how we deal with it are different, but the essential prohibition as an interpersonal prohibition, that certainly still applies. And this contract is null and void. And the purchaser was not obligated to pay at that price. Once you separate the two, you also have it in the opposite direction as well. And it also comes out that even if it was inadvertent, if there was a mistake, and the seller had innocent intentions, but the fact is he sold something way out of whack in terms of what it should be, so then the consequences still do apply. So then the sale could still be canceled under those circumstances. So you could have the violation without the consequences, and you could have the consequences without the violation. Then if the person did it innocently, but the price was way out of whack, it would still be reversed. And if the person did it not innocently, but the differential was less, it would still be prohibited. There is a whole discussion. The Ramah has two days that if we say that after a certain point the sale is negated, so do we mean that it's only the purchaser, let's say again using our standard example, the seller overcharged, so the purchaser has the right to negate the sale, or do we say that the seller also has a right to negate the sale? And then there's also a discussion, is also machlokas, what about in our original model? What if the seller sold an item that was defective and the buyer has the right to say it's a voided sale? But what if the buyer doesn't want to, but the seller decides, okay, maybe I'll take it to the next chump, so let me get it back so I can overcharge somebody else. So the buyer says, listen, just give me the actual price and I'll keep it. And the seller says, no, I want to take it back. Does the seller have that right? That was a machlokas. But what the later poskim point out is that even those who allow the seller to back out also would agree that if the price has gone up since then, so now the buyer wants to keep it because otherwise he'll have to pay more to get it from somebody else, that's the buyer's privilege. He has the right to keep it under those circumstances. Hi.
How are you able to say that by technically wrong, you strengthen your claim on this item? Like, technically, it's sold.
You're right. On the surface, doesn't seem to make sense. It seems like we're rewarding the sinner, except that if we're basically saying that the sale was completely void, so then that means it's void. You know, if the sale was a complete phony, so then it could be that simply a reality. If we work off the assumption that the sale was nothing, so then it's a reality which would cut in both ways. Even though it would cut to the benefit of the, you know, certainly we say the example I gave just to give him a motive, but you know, we certainly, in terms of the legal perspective, we certainly don't endorse him now taking it and shooting the next guy. Just trying to give an example of why he would want to do it. Or for whatever reason, the seller decided that he was only willing to sell it if he could cheat the guy in the sale. But if he has to sell it for the actual price, he doesn't want to sell it. He wants to keep it. So maybe he'll decide, all right, so if the sale is undone, he'll hold on to it. So that was a machlokas whether he has that right also. But again, the later svarim point out that even if he has that right, that's only assuming that he's not going to really leave the buyer completely disadvantaged. But if the buyer is not going to be able to get it at the right price from anyone else now because the price has gone up, so then that's presumably his right. We also find, there is a whole discussion about this, that it's not only if you're buying something that you have a prohibition, but it's also if you are renting something. So if you're renting something, we have this whole discussion in the Gemara whether when you rent something, are you considered to be like the owner during the time that you rent it, or does the original owner still maintain the ownership? Do we say Schiris Kanya or not? So if we tend to assume that Schiris Lo Kanya, that the renter doesn't really own it, the owner still has it. So it's interesting that Onah still applies because nothing's really being sold here. So what the Vilna Gaon and others have comment here is that you see that Onah is not limited to a sale of an item, but that any monetary transaction where there is a going rate, where there is a market rate, to wildly deviate from that would also be subject to a prohibition of Onah. So it would seem to be that that would also apply if you're dealing with workers also, if you're dealing with hiring a service and the service you way overpay. Of course, here the market's going to be even more differentiated because people have all kinds of different abilities and there are all kinds of different contexts and no two jobs are the same. So whatever issue we had before in pinning down the exact numbers, you'll have that issue all the more so when dealing with services. But nonetheless, if you can pin it down, or to whatever extent the numbers are completely out of whack, so you have a prohibition of onah in that context as well. That's how we generally assume. The Rambam seems to distinguish between a polol, who's a worker who works by the hour. Maybe there is no such concept of onah in that context. But if you have a kablan, if you have somebody who goes by the job, and there is a going rate, then you can match it exactly to what his abilities and what the job requires, et cetera, et cetera. So then you would have a prohibition of onah in that context as well. In the time we have left, there's a lot more you could say about onah the, at least at home, I have at least one 400-page sefer or so that's all about Ona. There's a lot you could say about it, but again, we're trying to keep things limited. I want to talk a little bit about the other prohibition that also is called Ona, which really exists in a different realm. It really is a very different concept, but it has many business applications. So I want to talk for a few minutes about that, about the concept of Ona's Dvarim, and how that applies in the business realm. But maybe before, just to mention one other very interesting application and important question. The whole concept of Mekach Tos, so you may be familiar that this plays a large role in marriages also. If you follow at all anything in the context of the get situation, the question of a woman who is not able to get a get and the like. So sometimes there are circumstances, where Moshe Feinstein has tshuvas about, where theoretically, and this goes back already to the Gemara, that theoretically a marriage could be under false pretenses. It could also be subject to Mekach Tos. That if there was a blatant flaw that was concealed from one party or the other, so then the marriage itself is also subject to Ona and Bittul Mekach, so to speak. Hi.
So, I mean, nowadays, I'm under the assumption that every suda has like the woman of suda, but even though it's not necessarily true, so how does that play into Mekach Tos?
Yeah, that's actually not so much the case. If you have a ksuba that says that when it's not true, then usually, although there is some debate about this, usually the chassan knows that it's not true. So the chassan,
though, isn't it?
Yeah, but the chassan. So the in the cases where you see it when it's not true, so the assumption is that very often there's a whole literature about this, but sometimes it's read out loud at the wedding even if it doesn't say it. So at most weddings where it's a first marriage, if it's not a first marriage, it doesn't matter. But if it's a first marriage, even if the kallah is not a besula, so under the chuppah they'll read besula, because who needs to advertise that to the whole world? But the ksuv itself may or may not say it. Sorry?
Who's paying attention already?
Oh, you'd be surprised. Yeah. Everyone. No, not people, yeah. It's interesting that you think nobody's paying attention. But in Israel, they pay a special attention. I just learned this because there's a whole slot for the Tosefes Ksuba. So people add random sums of money into the Ksuba. So as I was just learning in a recent wedding in Israel, that they say that everyone pays attention to the Ksuba because they want to hear the what the sum is that the person is going to add in. In the American Ksubas, you don't have a normal course. They don't add in wild sums of money or any extra sum.
The point of the wedding is that everyone starts talking under the
chuppah, no? Some people start talking and some people listen. So in any event, but just to address Brett's point, so usually it's the case that the chassan knows that if they actually wrote in the ksuba, so it's not just that they said it, so that many poskim allow also under the assumption usually that the chassan knows about it and has agreed to contract himself to the higher rate and doesn't care that it doesn't reflect the reality.
So we're more worried about the person agreeing to pay that sum versus just what he's getting?
Yeah, well, basically, because the assumption is, the question is whether he cares, and a person who's makbid on that, who wouldn't marry somebody who's not a psula, and if that's the person's consideration, and she represented herself as a psula, so then you theoretically do have a Mekach Tos. But the cases that I think you're referring to, usually there isn't any misrepresentation at all. Usually, not to the, between the couple, at least. The chassan knows this, and he's decided to contract to it. So, in any event, in the context of a marriage, if a couple is dishonest with each other in a significant way, in a way that the other one would not have entered the marriage had they known X, so then theoretically there are grounds to say that the whole thing is null and void. It's a very, very tricky area because, as you can imagine, that can be applied too loosely and it's been the subject of a lot of controversy. But theoretically, the concept is there. Theoretically, if there was actual material misrepresentation at the time of the wedding, then the marriage may indeed be null and void. So with that in mind, therefore, during the dating process, or at least by the time engagement, or at very least by the time marriage takes place, it is crucial that neither spouse is concealing anything, neither party is concealing anything material that the other party would choose not to marry them, because that would invalidate the whole thing. That would create a mekachtos onah type of situation. So there is a very, very extensive literature about medical conditions and about past history and about all kinds of circumstances where a person has to know what does he have to disclose, what does he not have to disclose, what exactly falls into this category, what doesn't fall into this category, etc. But there is an interesting question that goes beyond all this. This is all very, very practical, very important stuff. But there was an even more fundamental question. Goes back to what we mentioned at the beginning, the Stipler and his Sefer on Yevamis. So he raises the following question. He says that, okay, so listen, we'll all agree that anything that's material enough that they wouldn't have married each other had they known, that has to be revealed. That's also a whole literature. When do you reveal it? Right? That also gets into a lot of other questions, first date, third date, engagement, marriage, whatever it is. But it has to be revealed before the wedding. But what if you have something, says the Stipler, what if you have a circumstance where it's not enough to call off the deal? They would marry each other even if they knew this. But they think they're getting, so to speak, excuse the crass language, they see they're getting a better deal than they would be getting otherwise. Right? Didn't we say at the beginning that Kenevas Das? And we mentioned when we talked about the distinction at the beginning that if you sell an item in a way the purchaser would not have bought it or would not have bought it at that price, that's onah with potential bitul mekach. But if you sell an item and you give them the impression they're getting a better deal than they are actually getting, so then it doesn't cancel the sale, but it's an isser of gneivas das. So how do you apply that into the dating realm? Right, so if you say that even if they would go ahead with it, even if it's not any fact that if you hold back it would have interfered, or if you revealed it, it would have interfered with the wedding, but maybe you should say you mamish have to reveal every little flaw you have in your life, because the other person, so we're talking about boys here, the girl shouldn't think that she's getting a more perfect guy than she's actually getting, even if she would have married you anyway. So of course that's an impossible conclusion, right? Because nobody reveals everything about themselves, and if they do, I guarantee you they're not going to get married, right? That's just not normal, right? So nobody reveals every little problem they've ever had in their lives, even including the things that are too small to have a potential of the other party refusing to marry them because of it. So okay, so then how do we avoid the problem of Gnevas Das in those circumstances? Yosef?
Could you say maybe that as opposed to, let's say, business situation, when it comes to marriage, there's things like shalom bayis to consider. There's like there are other maybe halachic ramifications which may overpower.
It's interesting that in one place the Stipler says something along those lines, and he says that maybe the realization that nobody can get married without this outweighs the possible gnevas das. That's a little bit of the less, he does mention that as a possible answer. It's a little bit of a less satisfying answer. He gives another approach which is much more satisfying, which I will share with you in a second. Fesky?
Maybe like what we were saying with the rush beforehand, like there's normal market fluctuations, meaning that people understand that when you're married someone, there's obviously law that they're not telling you about, because it would be impossible, or else anybody, like you said, would start spilling out every single flaw that they had and nobody would get married. People are vocal.
Right, so it's interesting, actually, also the Klausenberger Rebbe, and his Tshuvas Divrei Yatziv. So he also talks about this, and he addresses the question himself, and he says something along those lines, that he says actually is a takanas, essentially as if there was a takanas hashuk, that as if we made a communal rule in for the marketplace, that theoretically one law could have applied, but in order for the market to survive, we made a different across-the-board policy. So he has an interesting expression. He says essentially a minig to be ma'alim ayin. There's a minig to not pay attention to certain things, to turn away from certain things. That we recognize that if everybody's going to demand the theoretical concept of perfection, whatever that means, so nobody's ever going to get married. So we have a minig to not pay attention to things below a certain threshold, however you want to quantify that and however you want to understand that. So that's similar to the approach he takes. But the Stipler has a fascinating approach where he says as follows, that unsurprisingly, we're being led astray a little bit by confusing, by paralleling people and merchandise to too close a degree. It says, yes, it's true. Let's go back to the example we mentioned at the very beginning. Right? Let's say, okay, I sell you a car. And I sell you the car for $1,000. And it's worth $1,000. So there's no monetary deception. But I tell you it's worth more. Or I don't tell you, for example, a better example, let's say I don't tell you that the radio doesn't work. Okay, so I sell you a car and I don't tell you the radio doesn't work. So, all right, you're annoyed, but you're not going to take the car back for that. You would keep the car anyway if I told you that, you know, that's it. Right, so, well, the air conditioning may be a bigger dish. But you're not going to, you would have bought the car anyway without the radio, and you would have paid the same amount, but you thought it had a radio, and you didn't know that it didn't have a radio. So there you have a potential gnevus das, right? That the guy paid $1,000 for a car that he thought had a radio, and in reality, it doesn't have a radio. And he would have paid the same $1,000 for a car without the radio, but he thought he was getting a better deal than he's actually getting. So why is that not comparable to a human being who conceals his lack of perfections before getting married? Because in the case of the car, so yeah, the guy would not bring back the car and return it. But let's say somebody were to say, okay, I will trade you. The seller would come back and say, listen, I sold you a car without a air conditioner, without the radio. I am willing to trade it. I will give you a car exactly like the one you bought that does have a radio in exchange. Would you take it? So presumably you would. If you offer you the trade and fix this detail, you'd presumably take it. So says the Stipler very wisely, when dealing with human beings, there is no such thing. Right? You take a happily married couple who, let's say, 20 years later, they've discovered all the flaws that they didn't know about before they were dating, but they're still very happy that they married each other and they wouldn't trade it in for a second. So then you say to the wife, listen, I know you've been happily married for your husband for the past 20 years and you don't regret it, but I'll trade you, I'll give you a perfect version of your husband instead. So the whole concept makes no sense. The whole idea doesn't really follow. So when you try to transfer, itself a Musar Haskel for the whole dating experience, that yes, to a certain extent, there is a certain parallel to the business world, and yes, there is a certain need to approach it a little bit like it's a transaction, but it's also possible to get very lost in that model and to take it too far to see the others as commodity and to, as commodities, and to lose the realization that human beings are simply not subject to the same type of analysis as merchandise is, and that itself is probably a valuable Musar Haskel. But in any event, that's how the Stipler explains why the model breaks down in terms of this Onah Gnevus Das model. Yes, the Onah Mekach Tos component is still there in the marital relationship, but in terms of this Gnevus Das component, so that which would lead otherwise to the impossible conclusion that you can't get married unless you tell every flaw that you've ever had in your life, so that we don't have to worry is a violation of Gnevus Das. Otherwise, again, nobody would be getting married ever. Okay, so let's just take a few minutes to talk about the very important correlate of Onas Dvarim. So the Mishnah says in the end of the fourth parak above Metziah, most of the fourth parak is talking about Onah from around Daf Memtas to Daf Nun Zayin and Chesed. So the Gemara is talking about Onas Mamon and all the different rules. And then the Mishnah says that Kishem Shiyesh Onah B'Mamon Kach Yesh Onah B'Dvarim. That not only is it possible to violate Onah in the context of monetary transactions or involving the money itself, but it's also possible to violate Onah in the emotional realm by hurting somebody's feelings. And that's a very serious prohibition. That's one of the underlying prohibitions involved in embarrassing someone in public, probably also embarrassing them in private. And as you can imagine, it's something that has a lot of relevance to the larger business corporate context that we've been addressing. The Gemara does right away bring up a business context. The Gemara has an interesting example, and this is something which we learned at a very young age, and I think all of us have been confronted with this, that if you go into a store and you ask how much something costs, and you have no intention whatsoever of buying it, so then that is apparently included in the list of what is Onaz Dvarim. So why is that the case? Why is that an issue? So it's interesting that there are a number of possible perspectives, at least three possible ways of understanding why there's something wrong with that. You wanted to comment on that? So one understanding is that, probably the most common understanding, is that the person becomes disappointed, that excites someone and then have them be disappointed is a painful experience. Disappointment is very hurtful. And to put someone through unnecessary disappointment, they think they're going to make a sale, they think they're going to get some profit here, and really there's no potential of that. So that is itself something, dashed expectations, as Rabbi Levine put it, that is something that is itself an emotional hurt. Hi.
But in that sense, that specific case, like nowadays, a lot of times window shopping, like somebody will go into the store and it's almost a given that if you know you're higher than Amazon or whatever, that somebody's going there to touch the product and then they're going to buy it at Amazon.
Right, so that's why it's also interesting to note that if you want to know to what extent that's an issue or not, that there are a range of interpretations as to what is the issue in the business context. So the most common interpretation, it's the way the Meiri says it and others, is that it's because of the disappointment. The person thinks he's going to get a sale, and that's not even a possibility. Now you'll say, okay, so then maybe I shouldn't ever inquire unless I'm definitely going to buy. I might risk disappointing someone. So we find that a condition in Onas Dvarim is that it's unnecessary. Clearly, there are a lot of times in life when you're going to end up hurting people's feelings, and it's necessary. So you can't live a life where you're never going to hurt anyone's feelings. But to hurt someone's feelings for no reason, where there isn't any justification for it, that's where you have such a prohibition. So if you need to have a normal business interaction, you need to ask how much something costs, because maybe you'll buy it, so then that's part of the regular give and take. But if there's no chance you're going to buy it, so then that's a needless disappointment for this person. The Rashbam understands it a little differently. The Rashbam understands it that essentially you are causing this person a possible monetary loss, because while he's dealing with you, he's not going to deal with a paying customer, potentially. Sorry? Right, so then somebody else could come in, or maybe indeed...
I'll be browsing beforehand.
Right, maybe, so that's also, I think that's definitely a way to address it, which is you know, what I've always done. You tell the seller, you tell the buyer, tell the store guy right away that you're not really in the market to buy this, but you're just curious what this costs. You know, that presumably mitigates a lot of the issues. That point that you're going to take up a resource that could be used to actually profit, so that probably was reflected in what they quote in the name of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, that you guys are too young to know this, but there used to be something called a phone booth that before everyone had... So yeah, right. Well, you've heard of Superman? Right, so there used to be that before people had phones in their pockets, so there used to be you'd have to go looking for a phone. And it would be attached to the wall in various places, and there would be little mechitzas that will separate them from each other. So many people had a practice, if they had to daven mincha in public, and they didn't want to look funny like they were talking to themselves, so they would go into a phone booth and pick up a phone, and they'd pretend they were talking to somebody, and they wouldn't look as crazy as they would otherwise. So reportedly, Rebekah Kamenetsky was opposed to this, because he felt that you are depriving the phone company of the potential profit, that people, those phones they put there so that people can use them to pay them, and no one's going to do that while you're using it and not paying for it, so that is a diverting of their resources away from their profit-making potential. So is that theft? Not exactly. It's causative, what exactly is it is a good question, but maybe it's at least in this category of using the salesman's time when you don't really intend to provide any potential profit. Hi.
If you had put in your two quarters, the phone booth, just to get your 2 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, the problem is it won't stay there. It'll fall right out. There's no real way to do it. And again, this is, you know, before your time, they had such things. But, yeah.
35 cents.
Yeah, whatever it was back in those days. But, yeah, theoretically, there might be a way to deal with it. Rabbi J. David Bleich of our yeshiva had an article he printed in one of the Hebrew journals, I think it was in Hadarim a number of years ago, where he suggested a whole different interpretation. That he says all the examples when the Gemara talks about Onas Dvarim, and the Gemara gives a number of other examples. You know, the Gemara says that if you remind someone of their past transgressions, somebody has repented, somebody has done tshuva, and you remind him of what he's done in the past, so then that's a violation of Onas Dvarim. So he explains in general that he thinks the link between all the examples is that you are treating the other person as inferior to you. And that's essentially what all of Onas Dvarim is about. So in the context of pricing an item, you're asking how much an item costs, you don't intend to buy. So I think the way it reflects that principle is normally if you're thinking of buying something, so you go into a store, you ask how much it costs, so you're essentially relating to this person as an equal. He's thinking of making a profit and selling you something. You're thinking of getting something you want and buying it. So you're having a conversation which potentially could be mutually beneficial to both of you. And he's having the conversation because he's hoping to possibly profit, so it's worth it for him. But if you're not thinking at all of possibly benefiting this person, and essentially you're making him your personal assistant, you want to know how much this costs, so this guy should serve your interest even though there's nothing in it for him. So that's a way of kind of relegating him to a secondary role, and I think that's what he means in seeing Onas Dvarim in this context. There are a few more important examples of Onas Dvarim. I don't want to give them short shrift. So probably what we'll do is, so next week our topic is Gneivas Das, again, it's a closely related topic, so we'll pick up from there. In a few minutes, those of you who joined the middle, we actually got a quorum for Meir, so right away after class is over, we will quickly daven Ma'ariv here. Hopefully our menu will actually stay. But just quickly review what we spoke about. We spoke about the fact that there is a prohibition of Ona. The Gemara compares it to theft, but doesn't really conclude that way, leaving open the question, is it actually a chiddush in theft, or is it really something different? Because essentially, it's an open transaction, a willing transaction between two parties, so it's really just a chiddush of the Torah that it is an agreement that is nonetheless prohibited. We talked about the differences between selling an item that's imperfect as perfect and a price differential. There are some differences. Right away, it would become negated in terms of its sale, and they have more time to figure that out. They have as long as they need. They don't have to just show it to somebody before the time runs out. And the question of how you define what's considered to be defective, and what about the person's obligation to check it himself, and a possible distinction between new items and used items. And we talked about how Gneivas Das comes into play also, that even if it wouldn't cancel the sale, so then you also have such a concept that if you give the person the impression he's getting a better deal than he's otherwise getting, that's also a violation even if it doesn't create a bittul mekach. We talked about the question of this whole standard of a sixth when it comes to the pricing differentiation, that more than a sixth of sale is negated, exactly a sixth you return the difference, and less than a sixth there's no consequences. We talked about how the sixth possibility, the middle possibility of exactly a sixth, doesn't really come up in the modern market. We talked about the general question of whether there's still a prohibition of less than a sixth, the question of the Rush and the Ramban, most assuming that there really is such a prohibition, that there's a distinction between the prohibition and the penalty. The Rush writes that, therefore, as a matter of practice, you shouldn't cheat somebody even at all, but if somebody does this to you, you should be mochel. He works off the assumption that generally less than a sixth people are mochel because of the price differentiation. We talked about how the general variability of the market today leads to a greater flexibility within that sixth, and maybe even beyond that, canceling out the whole possibility of Onah when you're dealing in very differentiated markets. And we talked about different situations where there is a prohibition without a penalty in terms of land, for example, and how land also seems to be the people are willing to pay exorbitant prices, and you can't really say they could go somewhere else and get the same piece of land, and maybe that's a part of it. And also the question of, is it really infinite, like the Shulchan Aruch says, or if it's 50% more, that's already too much, like the Rabbah says. And then we talked about some related questions in terms of dealing with other exceptions to the prohibition and penalty relationship, and that you could also have the penalty without the prohibition if it's done inadvertently. We talked about contracting for services and for rentals and for other things where you also find such a differentiation. And then we talked about the question of why this doesn't apply, why it doesn't seem to apply to marriage. It does apply. Mekach Tos does apply to marriage and has to be applied correctly, but theoretically it could apply, and therefore disclosure very much plays a big role. But how come we don't say that even if it's not material, but it gives the impression that you're more perfect than you are, why is that not a violation of Gnevis Das? And we gave the approach to the Kosenberger Rebbe that there's a Takanas HaShuk, a minig, not to pay attention to certain things, and the Stipler's major explanation differentiating between merchandise and people in terms of the inability to trade one for the other. And then we talked a little bit about this concept of anas dvarim, that the Gemara says that anas mammon is not the only category. There's also hurting people's feelings, and that has many applications in the business world, which we didn't really get to. We'll have to pick up next time. But we just talked about this one that the Gemara says about not pricing something you don't intend to pay, and we mentioned three explanations of why that is, either because you're dashing his expectations, you're disappointing him, or because you're diverting resources that could be making money into something else, or because you're treating the person essentially as inferior by not engaging with him in a real deal for his benefit, but for your own interest and curiosity, regardless of what he needs. Okay, so we will continue with Gnevis Das next week. And again, I hope at least the minion stays by. Who wants to lead us, Davening? Yosef? Alright. I'm going to go to the next one.